John has said that he is waiting for a phone call from you to see if you would play with the band again.
Don't listen.
I'm Allison Hagendorf. America, this is the next. Hello, Times Square.
Hello, Madison Square Garden.
Welcome to X Games Aspen. I'm Allison Hagendorf.
I'm the live announcer of the VMA.
Welcome to Rock This with Allison Hagendorf.
Yeah, this is Allison Hagendorf.
Hello, my fellow music lovers, and welcome to the Allison Hagendorf Show.
Hello, my fellow music lovers, and welcome to the Allison Hagendorf Show. This is where we celebrate the universal love of music and the rock and roll spirit that lives in each of us. I'm so glad you're here. We are coming to you from DWP Studios in Los Angeles, and I want to give a shout out to our presenting sponsor, Cloudwater, who helped make this show possible along with you. Your support means the world to me. Thank you. My guest today is the legendary Grammy Award-winning musician, songwriter, producer, and former Bon Jovi guitarist, Richie Sambora. One of the great things about Richie and Bon Jovi is their New Jersey pride. And although I'm not from New Jersey, I am from Rockland County, New York, which is about 20 minutes across the New York-New Jersey border. So I 100% understand and respect that tri-state area pride. My family came over from Europe through Ellis Island and just never left. That New York pride is in our blood. I still think New York is the greatest city, but I will admit that this New Yorker who hated on LA my entire life now prefers to live in LA, and I love it. I am grateful, though, that as a young adult, I got to live in Manhattan for over 15 years, cutting my teeth, hustling, constantly on the grind. And by the way, not that I'm not still doing that now, but the physicality of that in New York City, in the elements, is something you can only understand when you live there. When you leave your apartment, you have a massive bag packed with weather gear, outfit changes. There is no car to leave stuff in, and you are on foot all around the city in all types of weather. And by the way, this was before Uber, so you had to fight for your taxi. I mean, on a rainy day around that 4 p.m. shift change, you would hail and secure that cab to the end. Even going to Trader Joe's, insanely stressful. There was always a massive line. So you had to put a basket down in line to secure your spot. Then you would frantically grab groceries, throw them in the basket, push it up the line, and then grab more. Then once you finally pay, you have to carry all of your groceries to your apartment, rain or shine. I would wear weightlifting gloves and make it a workout doing a farmer's carry of groceries all the way home. So hardcore, so grateful. And very happy I am in LA now. But New York, you will always have my heart. Okay, coming up after the short break, we have Richie Sambora here in the studio. Stay tuned. My guest today is a legendary guitarist, singer, songwriter, producer, Grammy Award winner, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and Songwriters Hall of Fame inductee.
Okay.
That's right.
Please. Yes.
Former guitarist in the band.
Actually,
Bon
do
Jovi.
All that stuff?
Yes.
Jesus, I don't remember half of it.
That's amazing. He wrote so many hits that you know about, "Living on a Prayer."
For God's sake.
Ricky Sambora, welcome to the show.
Thank you
oh
very
my
much.
God, I love that. You're the only person who interrupts his own introduction because you know what? You need none. So you were right. We should have just cut to the chase.
Oh, thank you, darling. I'm really sorry.
Richie,
I'm having a good time. You know?
No, so am I. I know. I'm like gonna fly off this seat. I'm so excited. Firstly, look at this gorgeous outfit. Can we see the boots? Let's see the boots.
I wore my blue suede shoes.
Soft like butter.
For you.
Beautiful.
I swear to God.
Did you?
You know, I had no idea. I said to myself, man, you know, I haven't really talked to anybody in a long time about anything. You know.
Yeah.
Cut my
I'm honored that you decided to sit with me.
I'm honored that you...
It means so much to me, truly.
I know, and thank you. Because you're bringing rock and roll back.
Oh.
You know, and...
On a mission. You,
man, me too.
Yes, exactly.
That's it, you know, I mean, that's definitely what's going on.
It is. I just want to congratulate you on this new music.
Thank you.
We just start there? I had I Pray, like, on a loop as you were arriving, because I'm just so amped about it. I can't even imagine how excited you are to get this new music out. I mean, how does it feel right now? It's so invigorating at this point in your career to have
you know
such
what?
Great new music.
Yes. For a man of my age, it's kind of an amazing thing. But, you know, this was something that I've been making records, you know, for pretty long time now. Mm-hmm. So I never actually stopped. So the craftsmanship of making records is my pleasure to do.
Right.
And I don't hear a lot of artists like taking the time to actually do those kind of things anymore. But I do have the luxury of not having to worry about a number one hit or anything right. like that, because that would be facetious. I would have to be 18 or something like that, or, you know, doing something like that. So this is a specific genre, and, you know, I kind of hit it when I hit it.
And it's just great. You know, I mean, I pray just out the gate. It's such a beautiful, anthemic, rockin' song. You know, it's a banger.
Yeah. And you know what? If you listen to the lyric, it's about, really, I'm just a reporter on the scene as a songwriter. Mm-hmm. You know, just going, hey, we need to at this point, because things are a little bit discombobulated in this world, you know. And I was like the guy on the corner watching everybody go by, and was able to, you know, put it into words and music. And, you know, Bob Rock and I knocked it out of the park. You know, I mean, I think we knocked it
you
out
did.
Of the park.
And I love that you and Bob have reconnected for this.
You know what? There's four records that I've done.
Yeah.
You know, besides the Bon Jovi stuff that, you know, me and Bob looked at each other one time and said, how many records have we sold, you think? Yeah, like 68 million, 78, whatever that was, you know.
Something
and
like that.
And, you know, we always had an amazing relationship. And we were the guys that were working overtime, you know, like we'd stay in the studio later and then I'd go home and do homework.
Right.
So, I mean, yeah, the whole bad boy thing, you know, happened when I was like 22 or something like that. And that was my role.
Right.
In that band. So, and I said, I'll take it.
What's the songwriting process like now and working with Bob?
You know what? A lot of the songs I've actually written by myself. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'll send Bob an idea and then he'll start a track on it, give it back to me, and then I'll, you know, put my stank on it. And then, you know, he comes over and we just kind of do it. And then we get some of the greatest musicians that we can find at the time. You know, a bunch of guys from Paul McCartney's band, Abe, you know, on drums. I mean, guys from Sting's band and guys that have been playing with me, from Peter Gabriel to...
Yeah,
you know what? I always thought, since I was putting my time in on a corporate level with the Bon Jovi thing and doing all that stuff, that my solo albums were able to be more artistic and not... you know, I didn't have to worry about that kind of thing. I was basically expressing myself. And what that means is just showing what your roots are. It's an amalgamation of what you've learned and ingested in your life. And I happen to be a guy that ingested a lot. So I read a lot of records. You know, I mean, I read a lot of books, too. But reading a record like... is, you know, I mean, I got 20,000 listens into Beatle records and Rolling Stones records, you know, because I go back.
The greats.
I was born in that era.
That's right. And, you know, my question is, though, is this going to be an album? Is it going to be a handful of songs? Is it just going to be coming as
a
film?
Merck. You have to ask. I don't know. A damn thing.
Right,
you know what?
Right.
You know what? I think it's like...
We have four great ones now.
Thank you. Yes. And there's probably... 2.5 more albums worth of the same kind of passion. I believe that now I think people's attention spans are a little bit less. People can't get through an album.
Right.
They don't maybe have the time in their lives because they have so many things to do. You know what I mean? There's like a lot of things to do. You can't sit down, open up a record and look at the lyric and see how it pertains to real life in the present moment. And also... how it pertains to you.
Mm-hmm.
So as a songwriter, I always tried to be a reporter on the scene, yet ingest what was happening in the present moment and put myself in everybody's shoes so they could feel, we all feel it together.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, you know, there was a, and I think that that was one of the things that we did well in Bon Jovi, really, is just bring people together through, you know, my life circumstance.
Right, basically. Right. Well, let's talk about Thank You, Goodnight. And you...
Thank You, Goodnight.
Now, you watched it with John, right?
Yes, the beginning stages of it, yeah, I did.
Right. And what was that experience like?
You know, hey, look, this obviously was his personal perception. And his whole documentary was his perception, his baby. Mm-hmm. I really had nothing to do with it, you know. And there were some incongruencies about time periods and this and that, and it continues on. But yeah, you know, I think that I disagree with a lot of stuff or whatever, but I'm not like,
right?
Like, I'm not really shaken by it, you know, at that point. And it gave me a platform to go, here's some new music now,
right?
You know, where now it's relevant, because I think, a guy that's been around a block like me and my age needed a platform. You know, Merck convinced me of that, obviously.
Well, I think it's just like, it's a celebration regardless of Bon Jovi, the music. I mean,
it could have been more of a celebration, darling. We could have cut that down to about 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And because to me, the celebration would have been the great songs that we wrote and how we sold all those millions of records and played for people for 30, I was in the band for 32 years, which is unbelievable anyway. Like
it's
Five guys could be married for 32 years. I mean, that's incredible.
Yeah.
And that celebration of those great songs that people really took into their lives, that's what I believed, you know, the 40-year celebration would be myself. But but like I said, it was his baby.
Right, it was his baby. Of course, I talk about your departure, and you've said that you don't regret the departure, you regret how you did it.
That's right.
So what would you have done differently if you could go back? What would you have changed about that?
I probably would have left earlier. I might have left a couple albums before, because, you know, I think John was moving into a place where he wanted to not really be a band, you know? He, you know what? When we first met, he was thriving to be a kind of, you know, a solo artist in a Bruce way or a Rick Springfield way.
Right.
You know, how that was going to happen to him, you know? And I just said, American rock and roll band. And quite frankly, I mean, you know, it was an ultimatum for me when I just, you know, before Slippery, I went, man, come on, man, let me in. We have to do this. And this is, we have to make this a band situation. If we wanted to, we want to invade the planet and have people accept it. Meanwhile, you know, I think everybody was actually into the same thing, because we were opening up for Judas Priest and Kiss, and that we toured with the Scorpions for 9 months, who were the best. When somebody gives you their audience, right?
Right.
But we had so much shit flung at us, you wouldn't believe it, man. I mean, Tico had to wear a Yankees batting helmet because, and I would hear like nickels and quarters and whatever from That's every country crazy. Going, you know. I mean, the Cow Palace in San Francisco, they had to put up the chicken wire, man, you know.
But you were able to take that, the metal and the hard rock and the rock, and bring it to pop, because the songs were that good.
That was definitely the idea.
Yeah.
I just would tell the sound man, turn the guitar up or else the people are going to be like, we're going to get poison darts or something going on. You know, because it was like, see, I was able to like, you know, see it coming and duck it.
Oh my
but
God.
At least, you know, as a guitar player, during those first two albums and the first two tours that we did, I mean, you know, Doc McGee put us, he thought the same thing I did. This has to be a rock and roll band.
Mm-hmm.
So he toughened us up and he put us out with some heavy people, you know, and we're going, ooh, she's a little runaway. I'm going, please. You know what I'm saying?
He put you through it.
He put us
Doc knew what he was doing. He
you know what?
Did.
But that's what made it come to a head on Slippery When Wet.
Yeah.
And then that record sells like 15 million records that year and kicks everything in. And we had seeded the garden because we had played everywhere in the world. So every time we opened up for the Scorpions, wherever we were, if there was a day off, we played the theater or a club in that area. And you'd be surprised. It's like, if you have a dog, you have to pet it or it's not going to like you.
Yeah.
So in the music business, if you're trying to get around, you have to go back to those places and make sure that you do the press, make sure you go do the shows and talk to people and make sure that your presence were around. I don't think we had, a matter of fact, I know it. It's like fact. I don't think we had a hit song before Slippery.
Mm-hmm.
And,
So you decided to have many on Slippery. many.
That's very good.
Many.
Very good.
I listened to the album again this morning, and it's just unbelievable to have many smashes.
You know what?
Smashes.
The spirit of the record was fantastic. Because it either was going to go south or it was going to be great.
What was your relationship with John at that time and with the band? Like, it just felt like the planets were aligned for that album.
You know, it was a band that wasn't a band,
mm-hmm.
kind of thing, you know? And he still was pretty much really wanting to be that solo guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going, well, you got one more shot with me here. You know, and that's really, you know, it was an ultimatum on my part, really.
I see.
And it wasn't a bad thing. I'm just going, look, this is what I see and what the vision is. And it seems like the world is ready. And the garden had been seeded for, and then, quite frankly, so we finished Slippery. And I think the biggest American rock band back then was Van Halen.
Mm-hmm.
They broke up. I went, oh, well, there's the hole, right? And the record was already finished. So I'm saying to myself, yeah, the first record went gold and we're in debt. And the second record went platinum and we're still in debt. And then we finished Slippery and I go, I think we could do like 2 million records on this one, you know, if we go out and just kick its ass, right, and do that. It turned into, something that was, we became, you know, America's band at that point. And the world was embracing Westernism and it just exploded.
Yeah.
You know, and then we didn't even put Living on a Prayer out first.
Right, right. It like built up to that moment, then it was just like, see,
then it was over.
Yeah, then it
because
was over.
You know that song is about everybody. It's all about inclusion of how everybody has been in that spot in their life where they're going, are we going to get through it? Can we make it together? That kind of stuff, you know. And you know, my dad got laid off from his job. My uncle got laid off from his job. I mean, so there was a lot of things that were going on around us when that was happening. And like I said, a lot for me, I really consider, there's a lot of different ways to write songs, but being a reporter in the present is, through music and lyric, and people go, hey, wait a minute, I feel like that. I'm feeling like this, you know? And then when you add it with, you know, an event and some rock music, it's a celebration.
Yeah.
And it truly became something that really caught on all over the world. And I thank everybody for that. I have extreme gratitude for it, man, you know, sincerely. I mean, every day, I mean, it blows me away.
It's unbelievable. It's storytelling that everyone can relate to and everyone's celebrating. And plus the music itself is just so anthemic. It's just, it's perfect.
You know,
it's perfect.
When I looked at that audience, and I was the kid that was standing in line for tickets. You know, when I heard Zeppelin was come to the Garden, I lived you know, about a half hour out of New York in Woodbridge, New Jersey. And the train went right underneath the garden, so my mother would let me go when I was young, as long as I came back on the train by 11 o'clock, right? And I saw everyone. I mean, you know, everybody plays the garden.
Yes,
you know,
of course.
You know, start spreading the news.
Yeah, and like when you're from New York, I know.
You know,
the garden is everything.
So I had a chance to see everybody. And then the Capitol Theater, which was in Passaic, everybody warmed up there. The Stones would do 5 nights there. I'd be there 5 nights, unloading trucks like a roadie, stuff like that.
That's
like
unbelievable.
The Who, you know, you just name it. I mean, everybody just warmed up there, you know. So I got a chance to see the renaissance of, I believe, that seam in time. You know, I mean, everything was good when I was growing
up. Who was it for you that made you pick up the guitar, though? Because didn't you start with the accordion? Is that true?
I did, no, yes. Yes, and that, you know, yes, I come from, I'm Polack, mm-hmm. and yeah, I did start with the accordion, and whoever invented the accordion, they are a sadist, because there's a keyboard here, and there's 120 buttons that you can't see over here, and then you got to bellow this thing, and
it's challenging.
You know, like I'm like a 7-year-old kid, and it's bigger than me, but I'm acing it. Right.
So that was an indication that you had a knack for music.
Yeah, well, I had to change to guitar because you can't get laid playing accordion ever. There's no way. Just you know, you're the wedding singer, and that's what you're
doing. I think Tommy Lee started with an accordion as well, so it worked out for both of you guys.
It worked out better for me. Tom, I love you.
We love you, Tommy.
We do.
That's amazing. Cheers. This is so good. Okay, so then guitar. Tell me about the guitar.
Well, when my father got laid off from his job, he had to take on another job, right? And he worked on a place called E.J. Corvettes, which was a two vets from Korea that decided to make this kind of almost a Target, a smaller
yes,
Target, right?
Yes.
So my dad worked in the appliance department, which had these old Japanese guitars for like $30, and they had, but they had an amazing record department. So I was able to buy with my allowance maybe 2 records a week. So after my dad being there for a while, this guy put $5 down on a $30 Taisko Japanese made instrument and went to his boss and said, hey, you know, this guy's not coming back. And we need to get that out to put the new merchandising in, right? And he paid him $10, and he brought the guitar home. So, and I taught myself how to play from that guitar. So I just basically took that guitar and woodshedded, you know.
Wow.
Well, I was a kid that made believe I was the Rolling Stones and the Beatles in the mirror.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Every day.
It was innate for you.
I didn't know what I was doing.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't know what I was doing. But I played like trumpet and sax and obviously accordion and other, they just moved me around. I just had an ear for it, you know?
Yeah.
So basically it was a $10 guitar.
That's unbelievable. And you also loved Hendrix, right?
Well, that Hendrix was improvisation for me. It was the, to get to the point where you could get around your instrument enough where it came from your head and your heart and your fingers just did what you needed to do, right? So, had to figure it out. And plus, like, it was sexy.
Right. So
it, you know, I mean, it was like,
yeah.
You're basically, you know, you are praying, mm-hmm. you know, you want to get out of your whole body. And jazz essentially is the same thing, mm-hmm. you know, and where you're able to have the fluidity actually of just to go, you know. And when I looked at that audio, when I made it, after all the circumstance, and I looked at every kid as me, because every time I went to see my heroes, and I got to see them all. I didn't see Hendrix because I was too young.
Right.
Before he died, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And Janis and Jim Morrison. And I'd listen to Hendrix constantly, all the time. I mean, it's like, you know, he was just free.
Yeah.
His freedom was unbelievable. And don't forget the songwriting that he did.
Unbelievable. You know. Our son's middle name is Hendrix. We're big Hendrix lovers. Yeah.
Get out of town.
Cole Hendrix is our son.
It's
cool, right?
That is cool as hell.
Our kids, we're doing good parenting over here. They are raised on Janice, on the Doors, all the same. I mean, it's so, when you think about, you know, Jim Morrison, Jimi Hendrix, and Janice in particular, it's so tragic. You know, the 27 Club, it's just so horrific.
Oh, man. It's a shame that they had to get that messed up to get to a place, but, you know. It's like, I never knew heroin was that popular. It just never, you know, never got to me or anything like that. I couldn't afford anything anyway. I barely, you know.
Did you, I mean, in your debauchery and wild life, knowing that you love these three and you know the 27 Club, did you ever think about that for yourself? Like, did you ever fear, you know, that you wouldn't?
No.
No.
You know why? I'm a pussy. I couldn't, it just didn't resonate with me because I didn't want to be out of control. And plus, I wouldn't do good in jail. Let's face it. Come on. Yeah. Okay. Ooh, that would have been rough for me. I wouldn't have made it.
You know, it's also
that's
really
why I pay my taxes every quarter.
Yeah. You're like playing by the rules here. You can't mess around. Yeah.
You know.
But another cool thing about you, though, is, you know, growing up in New Jersey, in addition to being a great musician, you had this drive. Like, you had this work ethic. You were an entrepreneur. I mean, you had your own label. You were a part owner in a New Jersey club, right?
Yes, I was. And that's, you know, I had a couple record deals before I even knew John or anybody like that. And I was trying to monopolize, obviously. I said, well, I'm going to make an independent label. And I had a bunch of deals. And then I realized the political system, obviously, was if you're a manager or you have friends, they're going to get all the marketing money, you know. And basically, you're on a development deal.
Yeah.
When you're a young band and you're just coming up. You know, the case with Swan Song, when Jimmy signed me, they blew up. You know, they were like, you know, I mean, and whatnot, and they weren't speaking, and then, you know, my record, you know, ended up baloney at that point, you know, so.
You had to make it happen for yourself.
Yeah, I figured, you know what, I'm going to do some kind of regional thing, and an investor came in with me. He would come to see me play. I would be playing acoustically in places and stuff like that, and he goes, son, how come you're not a star? I go, let me tell you about the bureaucracy of what the business is,
yeah,
especially back then, you know, and a record deal. God, if you got a record deal, that was like amazing. Nobody got record deals or stuff like that. So I had a couple and, you know, I was a part of some of that stuff. So it was a growing up process, and it was about getting knocked around, and understanding that. So it didn't demoralize you to stop, you know. I figured, well,
it probably drove you further.
I'll get a normal job and I'll be in a wedding band or a club band on you know, when I could, and do it that way until you know, and continue to learn the craftsmanship of writing songs, and that was matrixed into my system, way young, you know, way young.
Right.
Listen to the Beatles and Dylan and Stones, man. I listened to Exile in its entirety the other day, and I was like, "Get out of town," or "Let It Bleed," and then, you know, any Beatles record, actually, you know, and I had worked with George Martin a bunch of times, and we became very good friends. I actually already did a couple of his lectures when he put out like Sergeant Pepper's How I Did It.
Wow.
He asked me to, yeah, you know, yeah, we became friends. Yeah.
That's unbelievable. Very full circle.
Yeah.
Prior to joining Bon Jovi, you auditioned for Kiss.
I did.
To replace Ace.
But, you know, at that point, I was taking any opportunity that I possibly could take at that point.
Right.
And it was interesting because it was my first time that I came to California. First time, it was, like, you know, early on in my career. And I ended up staying here, and I ended up catching a couple of sessions. And I would moonlight in Frank Stallone's band, Valentine. And take you back, right, all that stuff. So I would moonlight with them. So I was actually staying in Sly's house while I was here.
That's so
great. But I mean, with Frank, and then I would pick up a couple sessions, and I said, I had the club at that point, and Alec was running the business of that club at that point, and he says, hey, there's this kid, Johnny Bon Jovi, you know, I think he's got something. I'm going to go play with him. I go, Dad, I don't, you know, I'll be back in 2 weeks or something like that, you know. And then, Dorothea actually worked the bar in that club for me. But I was booking Metallica as a young man. I was booking Anthrax.
Really?
Yeah. I was, you know, when Aerosmith was, when Joe left and stuff like that. And they were coming back into these big clubs and trying to get their everything together. So, yeah. And then I'd book myself anytime I needed a job.
That's, I mean, you have been grinding from the beginning. It's still so much respect, and you still are. It's like, it's really admirable.
No,
you're the
thanks.
Coolest, Richie. So you mentioned Alec, and I did go back and watch the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction performance, which was so powerful. I mean, that was beautiful, and thank goodness Alec was part of it. And
yeah, he was still alive. No, he was my roommate, and he was the guy, actually, that said, you know, you should take a look at this. Because basically he was in this, the club bands were making like $5,000 a night back in New Jersey back then. You know, and it was bands like Twisted Sister that got deals and things like that. And he was in a very big band. And I go, what are you going to do though, man? I said, I got some backing. I said, why don't we just do something and go for the original thing? And, you know, because that's what I'm going to do. And if you care to join me, I would love to have you, you know. And that's how we met. And then he said, yeah, you should take a look at that John Bon Jovi kid, you know.
Yeah. Okay,
and I showed up, and I saw a lot of talent in John. And then I went back, and I said hi, and he was, like, very, very flippant. Yeah, right, you're kind of thing. And then 2 weeks later, he called me back and said, look, I'm doing a showcase for Chrysalis. And he wanted to do it at my club, which I said, no problem. He said, would you help me out? I said, Matt, send me a tape show.
Got it.
And within 6 months, there was a record deal.
Unbelievable.
You know, because I had, you know, we both hit the streets. In the old days, you just make cassettes and write songs and go to the A&R people. And I go, let me guess, it's Jeff Aldridge from Chrysalis, huh? And of course it was, yeah.
Right. I mean, you just had to make it happen yourself. You know, going back to the docuseries again, you know, is there anything that's not in there that you really wish people would know?
Everything.
Everything.
There's one thing that's not in there, and it's everything.
Everything.
Yeah, there's a, you know, like I said, to me, this is John's baby, and the beautifulness of what the songs did to the world and how that unified.
Yeah.
And music is the most evocative.
Yes.
And the most international language on this planet, and I'm living proof of that, because I could not believe it when in the 80s when we started the tour, it wasn't Western, the world was not westernized yet. And then a couple years later, everything really changed, and American rock and roll was really, really welcome, almost as my heroes, which were all the English guys, right?
Yeah.
What did they listen to? They listened to American blues music. They loved a Muddy.
Right.
And Albert. I mean, and you know, Freddie King and BB and Buddy Guy and those and Motown and stuff like that. So it was like, you know, white people wanting to be back.
Mm-hmm.
I am, my heroes are
the best music. It was the
best
music.
Yeah, man, that's what I want. Because it had soul.
It's
they were
soul.
Driven by a disparity sociologically, really. You know, and so it came out a lot. It hit a lot harder emotionally.
And survival. And survival,
you know,
yeah.
It really
For
did.
Sure, it really did.
Yeah, and then when Led Zeppelin 1 came out, you go, what was that?
Just his moves, like just everything about embodying
music. To see
music.
Led Zeppelin in Madison Square Garden a few times when you're growing up was like
what is that like? Because I had never, they're my favorite band, and I had never got I saw Page and Plant on the '97 tour, thankfully, but of course it's not Led Zeppelin
you know,
in the garden.
And still an amazing.
It was unbelievable.
It was unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, it's like, that's another weird thing that happened to me. I got to be friends with my heroes. That's kind of a mind.
That is wild.
That was a mind. When you think about it.
Really. Yes.
It's like, you go, I hang out with these guys now. It's like, it's insane. You know?
Do you still have those pinch me moments now?
Oh, all the time. I still.
Like who? Like, tell me, like, a
Susan. Everybody. Yeah. I mean, you know, anytime Bruce calls me up on stage and stuff like that. I mean, I had lunch with Steven a couple of days back. And last time Bruce called me up on stage, it was in Adelaide. And, you know, Bruce plays for a long time still. And he, yeah. You don't want to ever, ever go on after him.
Right.
So since I was a kid, he was very nice to me. And he would always call me up and kick my ass at the same time to show me that this is what you had to do. Kind of thing. You know, and
yeah.
That was very, very cool.
So cool.
And, you know, we're still obviously really good friends. And but he's another one. Jesus. But it's Jimmy and it's McCartney. And,
yeah.
You know, the list is like. Brian May and Queen. I mean, I just got, you know, Aerosmith. You know, I mean, my last tour, I was opening up for Aerosmith, you know, in Hyde Park. And I was just, you know, not with Bon Jovi, obviously, with my own stuff. And then in Queen and Australia and Japan and Korea and stuff like that. And, you know, we, you know, it was like, huh? What?
Yeah, that's surreal. It's
kind of
incredible.
Like, it's like a time compression thing where you go, yeah, I remember, you know, just sitting in my bedroom and woodshedding and trying to just figure the stuff that they were doing out.
But that's so special about you, that you're so humble and gracious. And I think that's what makes you you.
I don't know.
That none of this gets lost on you. You know, that's really special.
You know what? I still learn. And then you get, you know, Les Paul was a dear friend of mine invented the electric guitar and also multi-track recording.
Mm-hmm.
I played with him until he was 93.
Wow.
I got up on stage with Buddy Guy, I don't know how many times. He's like 83, and he will kick your ass.
I mean, that's
and
gold.
Down. You know, it's like.
Look at Mick and Keith. I mean, they're crushing at 80.
I worked with Don Was on my second solo album, Undiscovered Soul, and it ran into him starting the next Stones record. So they were in the studio next to me, you know. And I'd be like, in the back, like just watching them, their whole recording process and everything like that. And then we got to be friends. And then in 95, we had the two biggest tours in the world. And it was a couple of days off. And get a call from Mick, and they were playing a racetrack in Paris. And they wanted to do two nights. And if we would open up for them, it's like the Spicoli thing, man.
Yeah.
In Ridgemont High.
Yeah.
I'm going to go jam with the stuff. I actually did.
Right.
I
you
did
actually
that.
Did that.
You know
you
what
literally
I mean? For
did
real.
That. You actually did that.
And
in your life.
The first night, we got fruit thrown at us. Well, I did.
Oh, my God.
But I was, you know, I was sitting there and listening to mixes with Keith and Don.
That's so surreal.
And stuff like that back then, you know, and I actually. Half of my Undiscovered Soul record was recording at the Voodoo Lounge.
Yeah, that's amazing.
So, you know, it was like, you know, it's amazing how small the world.
Yeah. Do you see yourself playing into your 80s and 90s and
absolutely.
Beyond?
Absolutely. You know, I'm waiting for a master to come through right now on a song called Believe in Miracles. And I'm very proud of it. I think it might, you know, well, according to Merck, I think it might be one of the best things I've done. So I don't know,
that's
but I think
such an exciting.
I think
time.
I Pray was pretty good.
I Pray is my favorite so far, I will say. So, one other thing about the documentary is that John has said that he is waiting for a phone call from you to see if you would play with the band again.
Don't listen.
What do you think about
I
that?
I had said yes because. The fans would just love it. It's not finance. It has nothing to do with that. The world could use it.
Yes.
But as John said, he's been having problems with his voice.
Mm-hmm.
And now he had that operation with some plastic thing in his mm-hmm. larynx. And it's an iffy thing at best. I mean, you know, I don't know if there's anybody that has ever how'd that be successful? I'm not really sure about that. And I went to his house.
Right.
And we talked about it. I said, how is that now? Like, what's going on? You know, I mean, your brain, physiologically, it doesn't seem almost possible. Mm-hmm. Your brain teaches this plastic thing how to
function, to work for itself.
Yeah, like almost like you got to relearn speech in a way and things like that. You know, so like I said, first time I've ever really heard of that operation or something like that. So, you know what? I mean, I would definitely go. And, you know, I mean, I Pray was, you know, earmarked almost for Bon Jovi.
Right.
It's almost going to be that It's My Life moment.
I sense that, yes.
It was going to be that It's My Life moment. And if John and I do a duet on that particular song, and Merck is the guy that convinced me to hold it and wait, because he thought John and I were just like, had a bad marriage or something like that. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't the truth. He just didn't have it.
Right.
You know, and that, you know, that's not good. That's all you can do. So if he gets it back, I'll go play. I got songs.
So you're saying there's a chance. Well, you know what? I believe in miracles, and I pray that you and John will sing that song together.
I agree with you, though.
Okay, good. I mean, I love you, Richie.
I swear to God. It's honest to God true.
That's awesome.
You know, and it's like I told everybody that I would, without a doubt, go back. The world needs it.
The world needs it.
I Pray.
Yes.
It's about that. When you really look at it, it was about, you know, it's called life. Feeling full of holes. Oh, my yes to the no's. Hey.
I just think in a time right now where there's so much conflict and so many differences, we need every opportunity to bring things together and unite, and music is a perfect way
and
to do it.
And that is where my lyric writing and the songs really come together. And even and miracles, I mean, you better start believing. If you don't,
right.
Now's the time to try.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
We need hope.
Yeah.
We need hope. We need love.
We need hope.
Yeah.
You know, and it's really the truth. And then living alone. I started writing that song when I was very, very young. I was about 19 and a half. And
really?
I revisited it during COVID because just think about how many people were alone.
Yeah.
At that point. In a place where they didn't know when they were going to stop being alone, you know? And sometimes you can be alone in a relationship, whether, you know, so it has a lot of different
connotations.
A lot of different connotations. So it's a bit more of a somber kind of thing, but also using the electric 12 string. You know, when I did Wanted Dead or Alive, there was no electric 12 string on radio at that point. And, you know, being a Led Zeppelin disciple, obviously, where, you know, Jimmy used 12 string all the time.
Right.
I mean, Stairway to Heaven, people might think that is an amazing, amazing song, you know, and 12 string. So,
right.
and Houses of the Holy, I mean, you know, all that stuff was all 12 string. And it was on the radio all the time. And then there was a void that didn't have it. And my thing was to, and plus I needed to bring guys to the show because a lot of guys weren't coming to the show because John was like too good looking. They just didn't show up. But meanwhile, I had a rhythm section of Tico Torres, Alex John Such, and myself, Tico Torres, Hugh McDonald, that we played. It was heavy. Mm-hmm. We could stand up to, you know, that's what we did. We did Queen and Zep and everything in the cover bands that we were in before that. So it was that kind of thing. And I just said, let's. And then that riff came out of me in my mother's basement.
That's unbelievable. It's so special. It's so special. Are you still in touch with the other guys in the band?
Yeah, no. You know, it's like casually because there's a bit of a rift.
Yeah.
Because I didn't agree with everything in that documentary.
Right.
And it was, you know, I think in bands, like in any kind of even marriage, relationship, whatever, there's going to be blips in the radar screen. There's going to be stuff going on. And it didn't deserve to be mounted on me mm-hmm. so hard. And that was, Jesus, it seemed like a lifetime ago. It was like 15 years ago or something, 17 years ago and stuff like that that happened. So, and anything that I did well was unmentioned. So mm-hmm. I just shut up. That was
it. In this time since you leaving the band, what have you discovered about yourself?
There's life. Because we worked really, really, really hard. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, and especially John and I, because we had to write the songs. And I was always a co-producer on the records.
Yeah.
And so I spent every moment. So when the rest of the guys got a chance to live a little bit of that life, and, you know, everybody just wanted to talk to me and John anyway. And, you know, I've had some famous girlfriends on for... Which was a lot of fun, to be honest with you. You know what I mean? I had a great time, you know, and, you know, made some hit records and things like that outside of the band.
Right.
Also did my own albums and my own tours.
Yes.
And, so I think I had a lot of fun.
Looking back at your entire career and your personal journey, you know, what makes you the most proud?
My daughter.
Oh, Ava.
My daughter.
Beautiful.
That she turned out the way she did is an astounding thing. I mean, and she's just blossomed into an amazing woman. You know, just got her master's degree in psychology.
Amazing.
And going on to be a doctor. And we have a pretty crazy, amazing relationship, you know.
It's absolutely,
I mean,
beautiful.
It's just, it is a beautiful thing. And she just got engaged.
Congratulations, you know, I saw. That's
yeah,
so exciting.
It's awesome, you know. And then the other thing would be how the songs translated across this planet.
Yeah.
I mean.
And continue to do
and
so.
All I,
and continue
you know,
to.
I'm just a funnel. You know, it's not like, I mean, no. It's about the amalgamation of study and education that was matrixed into my system that you got to make a recording that is going to have that kind of gravitas.
Yes.
Where people are going to go, shit, I feel like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, seriously. I mean,
that's right.
So, and then once you get on top of it and you get a couple under your belt, how can you go backwards?
Right.
I mean, I never could, you know, but then when you're in a band, people interpret fame and fortune at different speeds and they have different lives and what goes on, what happened to them in the past, what's how they're interpreting it in this present moment that they're becoming rich, famous, and mm-hmm. all of that at the same point. I just never stopped working. Myself.
Right.
So, and I was lucky because I was virtually unaffected. I'm the same cat, man.
Yeah.
I'm the same cat that I was when I was 15 years old. You know, it's like the same thing. It's not really, you know, and I still got the same friends for 40 years. Same, you know, it's like the same group of people.
Yeah,
and, you know,
that speaks
a lot
volumes.
Of them, a lot of them are in the music business.
Are there words that you live by?
Love, peace. Understanding,
yeah.
Compassion,
unjudgmental,
mm-hmm. inclusion, oneness about the planet. Because, like I said, I'm living proof. I've been around this world. I can't tell you how many times. But you know, last tour I did with Bon Jovi was 18 and a half months in 52 countries.
Unbelievable.
Who can name 52 countries?
Well, I have a word, and it is grateful. Because you are...
That's another word.
Grateful.
I wake up every morning with grateful. Yeah.
I I'm just sitting here beaming because you are such a delight, and thank you for sharing your stories with me and with us. And I genuinely love this new music, and I'm excited for this era of Richie Sambora.
Yeah, it's a new era.
It is.
It's called Beyond Jovi.
Beyond Jovi. Beyond Jovi. Oh my God, Richie.
Well, there has to
you.
Be.
I know. Thank you so much. Ugh. We'll be right back.
And I'm passing through the E. Tell me if you work on the union's been on track. He's down on love. Stuff. Hey, we got a hold on. She work. Take my hand, we'll make it, I swear.
Oh, living on a prayer, living on a prayer. Is this happening right now? I'm dead. Okay, that was one of my favorite interviews of all time. I mean, I sang Living on a Prayer with Richie Sambora. It was surreal and awesome. Wow. Thank you so much for being part of the Allison Hagendorf Show presented by Cloudwater. A huge thank you to our other partners as well, Danny Wimmer Presents and Karma Sauce. Thank you to our friends at Arctic Zone. Thank you, Tribute Project, for my Couture Bon Jovi blazer. And most importantly, thank you. I would love to hear from you. So please like, comment, rate, review, whatever you're feeling, and reach out to me on socials at Allie Hagendorf. I'd love to connect with you. Let me know who I should interview next and what made you smile today. Thanks again. I'll see you next time. And remember, you're a rock star.